John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
We're going to talk about ageing today. We've got one of the world's expert and a very experienced, if not somewhat insightful, local elder full of wisdom who's written a book about it. So that's our theme. My co-host for today's Conversation Hour for this is someone who understands it from a somewhat different perspective. Dr. Ranjana Srivastava is an oncologist, a cancer doctor. She works at Southern Health. She also has taken to writing quite a lot about health issues, the medical system, and even things like dying that we never talk about. Ranjana, good morning to you.
Good morning, John Fain.
Thank you for joining me to co-host on the Conversation Hour today. And we'll draw on your professional expertise as well as your personal insights, I'm sure. And you've just handed me a copy of your new book, which I didn't even know was out.
This is my first book that I handed you a copy of, The Tell Me the Truth.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Conversations with My Patients About Life and Death. Now, I think we met you when the shorter version, was it like an abstract, a summary of this had been published in short form?
I was actually on the Conversation Hour with Walid while you were away discussing this book. Yes.
Not cheating. Now, conversations about death are the sorts of things that many of us struggle to do as a community, not just as individuals. So how do we break down those barriers?
Well, I think, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book was to almost sort of debrief myself, I think, John. And I think we've spoken about this with my other book, Dying for a Chat. I think it's about coming to terms with the fact that where there is life, there is an end to it. And acknowledging illness and death and dying, etc. I think it's a gradual but a lifelong process. And sometimes I think working in the hospitals, I feel that we leave it till the very end. And that's why these conversations become so very difficult to have.
We also expect doctors to perform miracles, don't we?
We do. And I think that I don't know whether you saw there was a piece in The Guardian that I wrote yesterday, and that was responding to the Beyond Blue research about depression in doctors and mental health illness. And doctors have been found to have a very high rate of mental health, mental illnesses compared to other people.
Suicidal thoughts, depression, all those
sorts
of things.
Yeah, and I made the point that somehow we have come to equate doctors with infallibility. And therefore, I think we feel that we must deliver and we must fix and cure. I mean, all these words are synonymous with medicine, aren't they? Fixing, curing. But often we are not able to do that. And so where do we go from there? And so I think all this calls for an adjustment of expectations probably from both patients and doctors about some of the limitations of medicine.
What are they?
Well, I think being able to necessarily banish illness is one of them. I think we have made tremendous improvements in symptom control in many areas, and also cures, of course. But we can't fix everything. And in Dying for a Chat, the little book that I was discussing some weeks ago with you, we had a lady in her 90s who had suffered a stroke and who had multiple organ failure. And, you know, there was never any chance that we were going to cure all those problems, but we had a good chance of palliating her well and of addressing her symptoms. But I think as long as the focus is on making her completely better or fixing her, we've got the wrong focus.
As a community, though, we're obsessed with wellness, aren't we? We're obsessed with youth. We're obsessed with vitality, and we turn our back on anything that doesn't conform.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that part of that's the background almost to the imperfection that death then presents itself as? It's like it's a flaw in the beauty of life.
Look, it is. And I think we battle that constantly in medical practice and in our hospitals and clinics. And I'm not sure, John, that I have a good answer or a solution. But I think whatever the issue is, I think it will have to be addressed by both society and the medical profession. We need to do this as a community, as a society. It's a big issue.
I've always thought, as an outsider to the medical profession and the healthcare system, it seems very collegial. Is it?
On one level, yes. I mean, you know, and that's part of the wonderful thing about working in medicine is that there are so many great people to associate with and chat to and sometimes debrief to as well.
Very competitive at the same time, though.
Incredibly competitive. And someone was pointing out just yesterday that the competition starts not when you become a doctor, but when you're a high school student and you are competing for that place in medical school, and then you're competing for internships and residencies and a spot in the training program. It never stops.
And you're always keeping an eye out sideways to see how everyone else is going and whether you're keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah, but I sometimes wonder whether that's any different for other professions. I mean, I don't know, not having done anything other than medicine and writing, of course. I don't know, but certainly even as a writer, I do like to know what other writers are achieving and doing, and what other doctor writers are doing, for example. So, yeah, I think some competition is healthy, and knowing about what other people are talking about or thinking or how they're doing medicine better, for example, is really good. But I think that competition can also sometimes let us down.
Is it also, just finally, before we bring our first guest in, who is here from overseas as one of the leading voices around the world on longevity and ageing, which is our theme for today, Ranjana Srivastava, oncologist. Dr. Ranjana is my co-host. Tell Me the Truth, Conversations with My Patients About Life and Death is her new book. What do your colleagues think of you kind of straddling two different worlds, the world of medicine and the world of writing? It's a fairly unconventional thing to do. So do they approve or disapprove?
I think it is fairly unconventional here, at least. In America, there are a series of very good doctor writers such as Atul Gawande, Pauline Chen, who writes in the New York Times. But here it is fairly uncommon. I think by and large, people support it. I think that sometimes, especially the columns that I write, bring to light issues that we all think about and that we all ponder. And I've been pretty warmly received, I think, although a colleague did ask me if I put my kids to bed at 6 o'clock at night in order to write. And not quite true.
No, it's 6:30.
Yeah, that's right.
Sedated.
Before we go on, I have to tell you, that's right, I have to ask where the tea and coffee is. I'll tell you why. You look puzzled. My kids said to me this morning that as the host, John Fain was going to interview some important people, and you had invited me as the co-host to serve the tea and coffee.
Oh, that's very cheeky of them.
They're 3, 5, and 7, so they thought that was what a co-host did.
I hope you put them in their place very, very firmly. Well, you can play the podcast to them later on so that they fully understand exactly the true magnificence of your appearance here as my co-host on The Conversation Now today. Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, oncologist at Southern Health, and also the author of a couple of books now, Tell Me the Truth, Conversations with My Patients About Life and Death, is her new one that she's just given me a copy of, so I haven't even had a chance to look at it. Our first guest is Alex Kalash. He's a doctor and president of the International Longevity Centre in Brazil, former director of ageing with the World Health Organization. How do we deal with ageing in our community? How do we prepare for the inevitable? And are we terribly ageist in our modern sophisticated societies? Do we give old people a hard time? Our other guest also joining us on that topic is the author of a book about it, In Praise of Ageing, Patricia Redger, who used to run the Australian Children's Television Foundation. Now, she writes about what it's like being older. She'll join us as well on The Conversation Hour today.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Dr. Ranjana Srivastava is my co-host. I'm John Fain. Our first guest is one of the world's foremost experts on ageing. He's the former director of ageing for the World Health Organization. He was an Adelaide thinker in residence. He's a citizen of the world and president of the International Longevity Centre in Brazil. Dr. Alex Kalash is in Melbourne in support of the Council on Ageing's Age Friendly Victoria initiative. And Alex, good morning to you.
Very good morning.
Welcome to The Conversation.
Thanks.
And this is an issue. We're not alone in this in Australia, although, of course, in typical selfish, obsessed first world fashion, we think we are. Who's doing ageing best around the world?
It's an almost impossible question to answer because it varies very much according to cultural norms, expectations, and how well prepared you are. What is happening today in the world is a revolution. It's the longevity revolution. You look at me, and I was not supposed to be here. When I was born, life expectancy in Brazil was 43, today 75. We have added 32 years of life, not of old age. And that is what we have to respond to as a society. And obviously, societies that are richer can respond better because they had a much longer time to age than societies that are aging now. It's much faster without the resources that, as you say, the first world had in order to respond to aging.
There tends to be a bit of a lag, though, doesn't there, between as people realize we're living longer, working longer, still being productive into an age where previously we weren't. It takes a while for people to realize and for business, government, everybody else to catch up.
And that's the problem, because we're still trapped on a 19th century mentality. When Bismarck created Social Security, he determined arbitrarily that the age of retirement should be 60, 65, because there were so few people that would still have the energy to work physically. And life expectancy at the time in Germany, which was the highest in the world, was 46. 130 years later, my God, we could do better. We still have the same retirement age. But now, say, for instance, in Germany, life expectancy is 82. And you still have to retire at the age that Dr. Bismarck decided, 130 years. Let us
I approach 60, I think it's a great idea.
Well, I tell you, I have passed and I have never worked so hard and so actively. And I think it's terrific. There are more and more people. I tell you, you look at me and imagine my grandfather who died 5 years younger than I am now. Yeah. And he died an old man.
Yeah.
And here I am, as you announced, you know, traveling around the world and active. And what's the point? Well, provide that you are in good health and you have knowledge. So these are the two things that are so important.
Alex, I wanted to ask you a question. In an accomplished career, I wondered whether you had a view about this. I find that one of the limitations of treating elderly patients and very elderly patients, especially in cancer medicine, is that there is very little in the way of clinical trials or good medicine to inform our approach. And everything we do seems to be extrapolated from studies done on healthy 50, 40, 60-year-olds.
Well, that's a reflection of ages in society as a whole. There is little money for research on aging. There is much less money in that period of your life because societies are ageist, the research councils are ageist, and doctors are also very ageist because we are not even trained to deal with old age. By and large, what is happening throughout the world in universities is that we are training medical doctors for the 20th century. They learn everything about child development, pregnant women, and then they have to deal with old age.
So I just wondered that in your role, perhaps at the WHO or other influential organizations, did you get much traction when speaking about doing more research on the elderly or studying health of more elderly populations? And did that translate into action, did you
feel? Well, you know, I'm certainly not so powerful as I would make it possible to change attitudes. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about is attitude. But we are doing this the whole time. The reason I'm in Melbourne is really to support COTA, the Council of the Elderly on Aging. And COTA is doing, and has been doing this for a while, how to prepare this city and this state in Victoria to be more age-friendly. What you are asking me is how can we transform society to respond to the longevity revolution I was talking before? Mm.
Typical of the baby boomers, they just don't want to let go and let someone else have a go, do they?
Yes, and this is what is going to happen now. Baby boomers invented the transition back in the past, 40 years ago, that we call adolescence. We create that because until the Second World War, people would transit from childhood into adulthood very abruptly. Now we are creating a new transition. Baby boomers are not going to age like their parents, let alone their grandparents. So we are creating something new. It's a new social construct, what is to age. And I call it the same way that we created adolescence, we are now creating gerontolescence.
And there's a group behind impatient to get the opportunities that were presented to us, you and to me. I'm not sure I won't guess at Ranjana's.
We are not competing for their jobs, John.
Well, but there is a bit, because there's this band of people who are in positions of power and influence in all the different professions who are moving their way through, and the next group aren't getting the opportunities that the post-war baby boomers got. Because the post-war baby boomers are insisting, as you just explained, on working through into the age where their elders would have retired.
Yeah, let me say that again. We are not competing to the same jobs. The job that I do today, I couldn't have done 30, 35 years ago. It's based on the experience. And provided that I continue to pay taxes as I go and work, I'm creating wealth, which means I'm creating new opportunities for younger people to have their jobs. And the life, the working span, is not going to be what Bismarck decided, as I said, 130 years ago. But it's going to be longer. And therefore, there would be, in a world that there would be much less young people and more older people with capabilities,
sure, but
it's going to be different.
I'll use you as a case study. I know very little about you. I've met you 5 minutes ago. You probably became a world expert when you were in your late 30s, early 40s?
No. I could only claim to be a world expert, as I'm still trying to do, as a result of 4 decades of accumulated
work. Yeah, but when you started to go to international conferences and the World Health and all of those, you retired at 62 because the World Health made you, which is a great irony that they've still got that policy. But so there you were probably in, what, your 40s?
Yeah, I did my PhD in Oxford, and then gradually I became more expert in what I do.
But someone who is a gerontologist now in their 40s is probably sitting there going, okay, I'm ready to do that work too, but all these 60 and 70-year-olds won't get out of the way.
No, on the contrary. There are many people that are a generation behind me that are world experts, and they are doing a very good job, and they're doing research. There is much more awareness because we have created this awareness back. We still have a lot to do. But what I'm saying is that if I interact well with these people that are one generation behind, like my colleagues here in Melbourne, I'm not dealing, when I come here, with people my age. I'm dealing with the people that are 40, 50, and often even younger than me. It is this interaction. In order to respond to the longevity revolution, we need to be in the same boat and speak the same language.
Maybe I'm projecting too much of my concerns here at the ABC as I look around me at all the smarter, better-looking younger people who are saying, why don't you just get out of the way and let someone else have a go?
I think you know, we probably need to change the whole paradigm of thinking about younger and older generations and stop thinking about it as an either or situation. I find that, you know, some of the physicians that I work with now are people who trained me. I was a medical student, and they're still there.
Yeah.
And now I'm working alongside them. And there's something really special about that as well. And something about that mentoring that continues.
What you are describing is a new theory that was developed by a psychologist called Erickson, gerativity. It is this interaction, the activity between different generations. And basically what he says is that as you grow older, I'm not interested in build a career. I'm much more interested from taking away a focus on myself to a much broader radius in which I will be far more satisfied to be guiding, to be mentoring, to be nurturing next generations. What I want at this stage of my life is to leave a legacy. And what you're describing is exactly that. You're interacting with people that want to leave a legacy for you to continue the work they had started.
And that's a skills transfer between generations.
Absolutely.
Absolutely
and
vital.
And the experiences that I have today, I didn't have 30 years ago.
And it's enormously rewarding when you see the penny drop with someone who you've actually passed something on to, you've taught them something, and you go, oh, wow, how good was that?
Yeah, but you have also to be aware that before, we were trained to, say, be a medical doctor until the age of 60, and life expectancy wouldn't go far beyond.
Now
we have
golf to
put more decades into life, and therefore we have to use these resources, also because they are far less young people. I'm talking globally, not Australia. I'm thinking broadly in the world. And the age group that is increasing fastest in the world today is the 80 plus. In 100 years from 1950, The 80 plus will increase 26 times. The 60 plus will increase 10 times. And the population as a whole, less than 4 times. So we have to accommodate these people and use and tap their experiences. And also because the economy will need our work in order to sustain development.
You know, the fastest growing population group in Australia, I learned this from Patricia Redger's book, who joins us next, the fastest growing population group in Australia, over 90s.
Yeah, it's throughout the world.
It's inc-
I said 80 plus, just generalized.
It's absolutely incredible. And of course, along with that, it's not just about living a long time, but the quality of life, which is the key to it as well.
And that is what you have mentioned in your book, is how we prepare to this finitude, to the end of life. And we brush under the carpet. Societies and individuals are not prepared. Doctors are neither. We are not prepared to deal with the fact that we are going to die eventually. Mm. And there is a lot that can be done. The ethical considerations, prolonging life unduly with no quality of life is as unethical, in my opinion, as terminating life unduly. When we have to face this.
Alex, can I ask you how these issues are handled in Brazil?
In Brazil, until very recently, we regarded ourselves as a very young population.
Right.
Today, we have 12% of people over the age of 60. But in 3 decades from now, we are going to have 29.5, which is the same proportion as Japan today. So it's a very fast aging.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is a difference, is that developed countries have, they first got rich and then got old. We are getting older, like India, your home country, before we are rich. So that is what you have to look at, the hundreds of millions of people that are going to grow older within the next 3 decades in poverty, without social security, without access to health and the things that we take for granted here. And if there is one word that combines well with longevity, is solidarity. That is the focus of my work in Brazil.
Well, I was just reflecting on what we were going to speak about today. It came to my mind that in India, just a couple of years ago, there was a fairly robust debate about having residential care for elderly people, which is something we take for granted here. And the question was whether or not there should be nursing homes established for elderly Indian parents, because it is such a it's an issue embedded in so much cultural and so many
and
cultural
there is a stigma
and social
and the
norms.
Families will
Absolutely.
Not want the same in my country, but we have to realize that this family care sometimes is a pie in the sky. The families are not prepared because women have joined the workforce. They are not available to provide the care. There are fewer and fewer of them because of the decline in fertility rates. And then we put the onus on you, woman. You are here, an oncologist, a medical doctor with your children, but society still expects, especially in India, in Brazil, that when there is a need to look after another person, that you will drop everything in order to do that.
And I think
so
that's,
residential care, just to finish, is very important because sometimes it is the only option. The family is no longer there to provide care, and then residential care is the option, and we have to make it better. Mm.
I mean, it just makes me think that there are so many issues related to aging that we will have to work through as a society, really. It's not just the medical profession or the politicians, but society as a whole has to come to terms with an aging world.
More age-friendly societies. This is the focus of my work in Victoria.
And let's continue the discussion with Patricia Redger, who joins us next. Alex, I hope Melbourne's kind to you. It's been great to be able to pick your brains as you make your way around the world, telling people about the topic that you've devoted your life to. Gerontologist, former director of ageing for the World Health Organization, whose own retirement policies meant that he had to leave the position of being the director of ageing at the inappropriately young age of 62. There's the ultimate irony. And now president of the International Longevity Centre in Brazil, Dr. Alex Kalash, our first guest, with Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, oncologist and author, my co-host on The Conversation Hour today here
on 774 ABC Melbourne.
Alex Kalash, our first guest, International Longevity Centre and expert on ageing, is joined in the studio by a local, I think I'll say identity, someone well known to many people in Victoria and around Australia. Patricia Redger for years was the director and I think one of the founders of the Australian Children's Television Foundation. Now, in what she doesn't like having called the third age, She's written a book about ageing, In Praise of Ageing. Patricia Redker, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
And congratulations on, I don't know, this is about your 843rd book or something, but there you go, whatever it is. Since when did you discover that old people were invisible?
Quite young, actually. Probably around 40. There's something that young women become very aware of when walking down the street, usually, and that they are being looked at and appraised. And it's something that goes on throughout your life. Until I found, after I'd had a couple of children, put on a bit of weight, it didn't happen so often. So it starts early, but as you age, it becomes more and more and more apparent. And as I relate in my book, the description of a friend of mine at 65, a doctor, who said she loves to sit in cafes and watch people. And her daughter says to her, "You can't do that, Mum. It's very embarrassing." And she said, "Don't worry about it. I'm invisible." And I think that's quite true.
And you also recount countless examples of people patronising you and treating you as if you're either stupid or deaf or in some way disabled because of nothing other than the passing of the years.
That's correct.
How common is it?
I think once you step down from an official role where people know you in that role and respect you in that role, and there's a loss of profile, and people who don't know you do treat you as an older person. Some of that's nice. They're quite respectful. Mm-hmm. They'll give you a seat on the tram.
Yeah, that's always good.
But being called dear, darling, and love, and a total kind of disregard for individuality, I find it's not so endearing.
It's good, you know, when you are first given a seat on the train, but it's also shocking because it is the built-in ageism. When it first happened to me, it was in Brazil, I actually thought that, you know, there was a mistake. You know, this young woman can't think that I'm so old that I need a seat, you know, and I sat quite embarrassedly and a bit irritated that I had been given the seat, so I was not that comfortable. But what you are talking, Patricia, is what psychologists and sociologists are now calling within a theory of social exclusion, exclusion based on identity. Yesterday I was a doctor, today I'm retired. I lose the identity. You don't have to be a professional. Yesterday I was a car mechanic, and today I'm very little. And this is what we have to change the attitude.
Well, I think you're quite right. It's not a monopoly of the professionals. For anybody who stops their job, there is a loss of identity. Mm. There's a loss of social connection, there's a loss of purpose. And all of these things are extremely important at every stage of life. And the thing, as you've been discussing, that we've been given the gift of so many more years, and it is something that we should be celebrating as a great success and achievement of science. However, we're sort of talking about ageing as though there's this great tsunami of old people who are going to wreck the economy. And it's very, very negative.
And that is what we have to resist, and we have to change this attitude.
Well, the first thing, I think, is to recognise that old age is not a disease. It's not... I think one of the problems is that when we talk about ageing, it is primarily about care. It's about services to the aged. And really, at 50, we are now entering what is the second half of our life. And the idea that at 60, you are called elderly. You know, you read in the paper an elderly person was knocked off their bike or under a tram, and they're 60. And they've probably got 30 years ahead of them I mean, my father lived to 95, so I'll be lucky to reach him. But more and more and more people will pass that. And we've just got to start talking about this period of life as something other than aging.
That's exactly what you're saying, that we have added 32 years, for instance, in my lifetime, from 43 life expectancy when I was born to now 75 in Brazil. But it's not 32 years of old age, it's 32 years of life. And
absolutely,
this has a very important retroactive effect, impact, in all the previous stages of life. As you say, we have to be prepared, prepare ourselves for a much longer life. And that needs investment on our health, vital capacity, in our finances, everything we have to prepare, not to live to 60, but to live to 90 and beyond.
Patricia,
but it's preventive health. Like, we've got to be responsible. We've got to look after ourselves. We've got to be active. We don't wait till we've got a pain in the stomach or something and head to the doctor and expect they're going to give us a pill. No, it's about active living. And also, you were talking earlier about the issue of stepping aside for younger people in jobs. And that's not the way the labour market works anymore. In my lifetime and in, you have grown up in a job. Certainly my parents, they stayed in one job. They retired. That was the end. But now it's about reinvention.
Yes.
It's about change. Nobody is going to be doing the same job.
Patricia, I want to bring you to some of the stories in your book, which I enjoyed very much, although it also made me cringe sometimes at the very obvious ageism that you describe. I want to talk a little bit about purpose, and in particular because I see a lot of elderly patients, and especially patients who have cancer, but often they don't, whose entire life seems to be dominated by their diagnosis and their disease. And you can almost see them going downhill because they have lost a sense of purpose in their life other than worrying about their disease, which is by no means unreasonable. But when I compare them to the people who do well, I feel that those are people who have got something else to concentrate on and somehow managed to bring themselves out of the disease occupying their life or illness and have purpose. And I just, and all the stories that you are describing, similarly, the people have had purpose in their life. And I wonder whether you have any insights into how one does that when one's entire life previously may have been occupied by their profession or by something else, and all of a sudden that comes to an end, or you become unwell. How do you still derive purpose in life?
Like most things, education is at the core. And the way in which we talk about people and address people has a very big effect on their psychological response and the attitude they will take to a stage of life. One of the responses that I've had to this book from people who've read it already is one of absolute relief and feeling inspired that we can be talking about their life as something to look forward to, not something to close down. You know, the attitude that when you stop work, life's over, because everything you do from this point on isn't work, so it's not valued. So all voluntary work or creative work or caring work, none of these things are even counted in the GDP.
And what you're saying, Patricia, is really the definition of the World Health Organization of active aging, which is based on four pillars. In order to age well, we need to have good health, and our investment is important on this, although I would slightly disagree with you, just in the sense that it's not only your responsibility, it's also responsibility of the society, the government, to give the opportunities for us to be healthy.
I agree with that.
The second is continuing education, to build on your knowledge, which is critical for you to continue. Third pillar of this definition, to participate in society. So you need to be in good health, education, participate, but failing that, we need the security the protection that should be given, in part by us investing in our old age, but also the society to give the opportunities for us to be protected. Otherwise, old age in poor health can be hell.
It sure can. If you don't like old and you don't like mature or elderly or third age or seniors, and you say that in the book, what do you want? How do we describe people who are of any particular generation?
They're people. And
but we talk about teenagers, we talk about young people.
Yes. But once we talk about adults, and there is no reason to go beyond that. We don't need at a certain point in time to suddenly say you're now in the category of old age, because that has changed so much. And old age, it's like very old age, maybe over 85, 90, before you now begin to deteriorate. Now, that's if you haven't kind of had an accident or been unfortunate enough to get a terminal disease. You get some aches and pains. You get slower. There's a set of things you could describe, but they're not unique to someone who gets over 65. You know, there are people at 40 who feel like that.
Oh, and there are people who feel like that even younger. In fact, speaking of younger people, why did you bring your grandson in with us today? Good morning to you, Ace.
Good morning.
Patricia Edgar's grandson, Ace Buck, has come in too.
Well, Ace has been involved in a project with Don and myself as an artist. Ace is 12 now, but at the age of 10, he decided he'd like to learn watercolours. And Don, who is a hobby painter, quite a good one too, I might add, decided he would teach Ace watercolours. And Ace came regularly after school to paint with Don. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell the rest of the story?
Oh, well, I guess it really starts from when I was really, really young, like three. I was always drawing. I always had a pencil in my hand. Whenever I went out to a restaurant, I'd always bring my sketchbook and my pencils. I'd spread them out all over the table and I'd draw. You know, it just kept on developing. At school, we'd have art classes. I'd be doing some drawing. I'd be doing all the different aspects of art, and then eventually it got. I was getting older, and that. How old was I? I was 10? Mm. 10. So then what happened was Don was illustrating a book which was called The Fairies of Plant Street, and he was using watercolours to illustrate the book, and that. So I was really interested in that, and so then I asked, you know, can you teach me how to use watercolours? And so from then on, I would. Every Tuesday after school, I'd go and I'd do some painting with the watercolors, and I'd learn, you know, this is how you draw, paint a tree with watercolors. This is how you do this and that.
So your grandfather passed on some skills too.
Yeah, he has. He's passed on a lot. And so then, what happened was Tricia and Don decided it would be a good idea for me to have a focus my painting on something, and that's where the book Big Fat Porkies and Little White Lies had come to be. And so what happened was Tricia wrote the book, and then every Tuesday would be spent now planning and illustrating the book. And, you know, it was quite a task. It took over a year. And so really it started with...
And what a wonderful result. You are so talented. It's wonderful. But what I would like to call attention here is this exchange between generations. Your grandmother wrote the book, you learned the skills from your grandfather, and here you are doing exactly what I was describing before, generativity. Mm-hmm. It is one generation getting the footprints and getting the inspiration, being taught, guided, mentored by another generation.
Yeah.
Congratulations for you as a family.
I don't think as my grandparents is old, they're part of my family, and I love them just as much, and I love learning things from them, and, you know, I learn probably more from them as people than younger people.
Yes, I thought your book came at a very timely time for my family. I've got young children, so the story was absolutely relevant, and all these things.
Telling lies? Your children don't tell lies, do they, Angela?
They dip their finger in the chocolate cake, and there's certainly that rung so true with me when Mum wears something and asks how she looks, or so I thought that the story was full of good morals for my children, but also this was so inspiring that my children's primary school is having a day where they're going to read this to the children and show them also what children of their age can accomplish with their artwork.
Well, that's actually really great, because also at my school, we Eltham College, we had a book launch for the book, and what happened was, I think the younger years, I think prep up to, I think, 5-6, I read the book to them, and then we had a discussion, and so all the children were, you know, really excited about it, and they were going, "Oh, I told this lie when I, you know, I stole the chocolate from the pantry, and I didn't tell my parents." And so we had this great discussion with them, and I asked, you know, "Who here loves to draw? Who here loves to paint?" And every single hand in that room went up, and they were all. I think they might have been a little bit inspired, and
just given me an idea. I have to talk to our principal about that.
Yeah. Telling stories about comparative lies.
Of bringing Ace to talk, John.
Oh, there you go. There's another opportunity, but it makes me wonder, Patricia. Maybe we need. You did the Australian Children's Television Foundation. Maybe we need the Australian Elders Television Foundation. Maybe it's partly. And here we are. We're on the media. We're in the radio studio talking about this, and yet it's a conversation that's rarely held.
I think that would be an excellent idea, and I think it would work extremely well.
Because older people are just shut out of the public discussion.
And you do not see them on television. I mean, before there was regulation of children's programming, you did not see Australian children on our television.
And you broke down those barriers.
And in the United States, before the civil rights movement, you did not see American blacks on their television, unless they were criminals or unless they could sing.
Or and sports stars.
That's right.
But Patricia, I'm going to be the devil advocate here, because in one hand you say that you don't like the labels, old age, old person, this and that. But you are now for a foundation that would focus on older people. I think that what we need is a foundation that would bring intergenerational dialogue. To bring older people, yes, but in the presence and with a dialogue with younger generations.
I'm not talking about an exclusive type Melbourne club for old people. I'm talking about programs that are absolutely relevant to people in the second half of their life, and that would include intergenerational programs, certainly, particularly through the media. You perhaps, Alex, are familiar with the work that's being done in Denmark at a group called the WAG Institute, and they are actively linking young people with people in care, people who seem quite far gone with dementia are in this program. And what they've found is that the older people are willing to learn. They want to learn. They love learning. And they love the link with the younger people.
Well, we're learning more and more about the brain and its capacity to continue to generate
and
ideas and be exercised like a muscle.
They didn't ask for their pain medication as much. Mm. And even they are living longer.
Well, again, you are putting a lot of emphasis on intergenerational. And within that theory of social exclusion, what we are also talking about, the importance of having older people present in to combat stereotype, it is social exclusion based on the symbolism. And what the media does when there is older people, it's more often than not presenting them as gaga, without having much to say. Mm. They are silly, they are patronized. And what we want is to have positive images of old age representing what we are.
But that's what I mean when I say we should be called people. I mean, there isn't a certain point at which you step into this redundant category.
Mm. I was also thinking that any sort of advocacy group or any forum that brings together elderly senior citizens, elderly people to interact with younger people must really try harder to have a multicultural inclusivity, because what I find is that working where I work especially, there is a wealth of knowledge and experience in people who have migrated, who are from different cultures.
Especially in this country.
Especially in this country, which is being even less tapped into than others. And I think that's a real shame and a waste of talent.
And media can do that so effectively.
Oh, yes, let's blame the media for everything. In Praise of Ageing is Patricia Edgar's new book. It's published by Text Publishing. In Praise of Ageing, Patricia Edgar, who was one of the founders of the Australian Children's Television Foundation, and with her, her grandson, one of her grandchildren, Ace Buck, who has collaborated with Patricia's partner, Don, his grandfather, Don Edgar, who used to run the Institute of Family Studies for years, if you're wondering where you've heard that name before, in putting together a beautiful little self-published book called Big Fat Porkies and Little White Lies, which is just one example of what you can still do.
And they can get that book on Amazon.com.
You can?
That's right.
Oh, goodness, what can't you get? Big Fat Porkies and Little White Lies by Patricia Edgar with her grandson Ace Buck. In Praise of Ageing is Patricia Edgar's book, and our other guest, Alex Kalash, Dr. Alex Kalash, President of the International Longevity Centre in Brazil, here for the Australian Council on the Ageing's Age-Friendly Victoria Initiative with Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, oncologist, my co-host. Ranjana, Alex, Patricia and Ace, thank you all for coming.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.